at 12 noon on this day, acting in my capacity as President of the United States, it is my high honor.
Okay, so this is President Nixon opening the World's Fair in Spokane in May of 1974.
74, officially open to all the citizens of the world.
And this seems like a really triumphant moment. There's this band, and if you could see the video, there have to be hundreds of balloons being released into the air. But you kind of have to wonder, was the World's Fair really what was going through Nixon's mind in this moment? Because let's just remember something. 1974, not a great year for Richard M. Nixon. So even with the band and all the balloons and the world, did his own life overshadow the fair? Welcome to Tales from the Fair, a special edition of The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Jessica Robinson. On this show, we're bringing you a series of short fictional stories commissioned by the Spokesman Review, all written around the theme of the fair and read here by the authors themselves. And we may not be able to get inside the mind of Richard Nixon today, but the writers will reveal that fairs are not always an escape. Our lives travel with us to the fair, and sometimes what people are hiding is way bigger than the fair itself. First up, a detective story starring a mysterious private eye with unusual methods. Here's writer Jess Walter.
Guy's name was Argyle Borfus. I hired him fall of 74 to track down my wife after she ran off with our hippie pool boy to this turdburg, Spokane, Washington. I flew up there, searched the campgrounds by the river. Nothing. Podunk cops were no help. Desk sergeant didn't even look up. We look like marriage counselors. Another cop walked over, said to the sergeant, "What about Argyle Borfus?" The sergeant hesitated, then smiled, nodded, and left the room. The other cop wrote a number down and slid it across the desk. "You didn't get this from me." I went straight to a phone booth. Trouble had started 2 months earlier. Sharon and I lived in Torrance, California, where I had the South Bay's biggest Buick dealership. Sharon was my second wife, 20 years newer than the model I'd traded in. It was good between us. And then she started smoking Mary Jane and dinging the pool boy. His parents told me they'd made for Spokane, which was hosting the World's Fair. "World's Fair, my ass," first thing Argyle Borfus said to me. "If there's one thing I know, it's that the world ain't fair." Argyle Borfus was a little younger than me, 45, thin, edgy, always pursing his lips, squinting, like he'd soured on the world. I'd called the number the cop slipped me, and the woman who answered gave me the name of a bar. Albertini's Last Stool. Sure enough, 11 in the morning, he was at the end of the bar with a cup of coffee. "They don't let me drink anymore," he said. I explained my situation. Sharon, pool boy, expo. He reached up to his mouth and seemed surprised not to find a cigarette. "$2,000 when I find the broad. You pay all expenses up front." I liked his confidence. And the money was no problem. He stood, tossed a crumpled dollar on the bar, and grabbed a stingy brim hat off the stool next to his. "Come on." It was a warm fall day. He walked us through a stubby brick downtown to a new white opera house, straight to a ticket window. "Buy us into the fair," he said. "Right, I pay expenses." I reached for my wallet. "And get 2 tickets to Helen Reddy," he said. She was playing the fair that night. "Hippies love Helen Reddy." "No, we don't," said some guy in line behind us. "Balcony front," said Borfus. As we walked off, a guy with sideburns leaned forward and said, "We really don't like Helen Reddy." The fair was nice. Set against that brick downtown, it was like someone had put a brand new kitchen remodel on a crap house. We walked along the still part of a river, past a cluster of international flags. I waited for him to ask about Sharon, but he had this way of not asking questions that made you spill everything. "My friends warned me about her," I said. "But when a woman says I love you, how are you supposed to know it's a lie?" "It's always a lie," said Argyle Borfus. It was a Tuesday. Kids back in school, fair not too crowded. A two-person chairlift moved above our heads, most of the chairs empty. Borfus looked all around. This party is in its last hour. The less he talked about my situation, the more I seemed to talk. About my first marriage, how I met Sharon at a boat show, how things had been good at first and then cooled. And then, I said, the thing with the pool boy. When I asked his plan for finding Sharon, Argyle Borfus muttered, "There's a guy I'm looking for." But he didn't seem in any hurry, stopping every few minutes to look at exhibits, Chinese masks, Indian moccasins. He had me buy us kielbasas and pierogi, lemonade, elephant ears, kid stuff. "Sharon wanted to have a baby," I said. I wasn't entirely upfront about my vasectomy. We passed flowers and jewelry booths, ambled in the crowd over a bridge toward a big, uneven white tent, like someone had dropped a snow cone. It was the U.S. Pavilion, built on the banks of a burbling little waterfall. There was a big sign inside. "The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth." Argyle Borfus stood stock still in front of that sign. "Minute this fair closes, the town goes back into its coma. I cannot wait." The fair got a little more crowded after school ended. We rode the sky ride, the chairlift that ran above the sidewalk slower than you could walk. Argyle was scanning the crowd when it dawned on me I hadn't even shown him a picture of Sharon. All those people below us, he was making a point, needle in a haystack. I pulled a picture from my wallet and said, "When she looks at you, the world stops." He glanced at the picture, big teeth. It was nearing dusk. He had me buy dinner, 2 plates of chow mein. We'd just finished eating at a park bench by the river when he saw what he'd been looking for and jumped up. "Give me $5. I handed it over. He approached a guy at a kiosk. They talked for a minute, and he came back with a leash. Nothing attached, just a stiff leash ending in an empty collar. Supposed to look like an invisible dog, I guess. I looked back over my shoulder. "So, did that guy know something about Sharon?" Borfus said nothing. Just walked his invisible dog. A pretty woman walked by. "What's your dog's name?" "Go to hell," said Argyle Borfus. We walked some more, his leash out front. He was doing his quiet thing, going over my whole story, figuring out which part was a lie. "Okay," I admitted. "The pool boy was my idea. I was having performance issues. I thought I'd like watching her with another man, but it really bothered her, like she was just a plaything. And I had no idea they'd run off together." Argyle Borfus didn't even look at me. Helen Reddy was pretty good. I left humming Delta Dawn. We walked with the crowd back through downtown, Argyle Borfus's invisible dog leading us. "Look, things got twisted between me and Sharon, but I love her. I want her back. I'm dead since she left." He didn't say anything. We passed the bar where I'd found him and went into a building 2 doors down. Painted on the window were the words, "Lilac City Mental Health" and "First Steps Independent Adult Care." There was a desk at the front, a woman with a check-in sheet. She made a mark next to his name. "Welcome back, Argyle," she said. "What's your dog's name?" "It's a fake dog." He turned to me and shook his head. "Stupid broad." My private eye was a mental patient. "Right." The woman at the desk smiled at us. Argyle Borfus narrowed his eyes. 11 o'clock tomorrow. Meet me at the Butterfly." I looked down at his invisible dog. I knew it then, or maybe I'd known it all along. I would never see Sharon again. All my money didn't matter. She was the pool boy's now. Man belongs to the earth, all right. "Porter Wagner and Dolly Parton are playing Friday," he said. Borfus and I stared at each other. Christ, the trouble we make for ourselves, trying to be loved. "Front row balcony?" I asked. Argyle Borfus winked at me. "Atta kid."
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on?
That was Jess Walter reading his story called Belongs to the Earth. And Jess says the idea for this story, oddly enough, all goes back to John Travolta.
My kids were laughing about this website, the Travoltaizer, where you could type in your name and it would do what John Travolta did when he messed up Idina Menzel's name at the Oscars that he did that. I think so. It would, you know, give you some gibberish name back. So my son typed in his name, Alec Bruce. Bruce is his middle name, and it came back Argyle Borfus. And so my kids said, could you write a story about Argyle Borfus? And I said, yeah, I'm going to write a noirish story about a detective named Argyle Borfus. And as with most stories, writing it is when you discover what it's about. And it wasn't long before I realized that Argyle Borfus was not a real detective.
Jess Walter is the author of 8 books, including New York Times bestseller Beautiful Ruins. His latest book is a collection of short stories called We Live in Water. If you've ever tried to win anything at the fair, you'll sympathize with the boy in this next story. Luckily, he gets a bit of unexpected advice. Here's Polly Buckingham.
Chester's sister Kat and her best boyfriend David left Chester alone at the fair. He begged and begged to play the game where he could win a giant stuffed dog. The dogs were almost as big as him and had glass plates on their heads. He wanted the St. Bernard dog most of all, because he had the saddest eyes. Don't go anywhere, Kat said. David gave Chester a $20 bill, an amount of money Chester had never before held in his hand. Chester understood why David was Kat's best boyfriend ever, why she was quiet and nice around him. It helped, too, that he had a big, beautiful face, and even though he walked with sticks, he had very strong arms. He walked with sticks because he had polio. He was also a great boyfriend because he talked to Chester as if Chester were an adult. He explained about the polio, how he'd had an illness that started with the word men, and that polio was not the same as polo. Polo was a sport you played with horses and balls and long sticks, something David tried to explain, but that Chester couldn't quite picture. The dog barker dug into his apron pocket and gave Chester 10 dimes and $19 and called Chester a rich little man. Every one of those 10 dimes bounced off the St. Bernard dog's glass plate. So he got 10 more, and those bounced off also. He tried to think, as he asked the dog barker in his red vest for another dollar of dimes, how he was going to get the dog back to the car. He was sure the dog was too big for him to carry, and David carried his 2 sticks, and Kat was allergic to dogs, but this dog was fake. He hoped that didn't count. It made him anxious to think maybe the dog wouldn't fit in the car, or maybe Kat would get sick on the drive home, or maybe she would just say no. Maybe they could call his stepfather, Bert Rose, to come pick up Chester and the dog. He thought these thoughts as dime after dime pinged off the glass plates. He thought about where the dog would sit in his room and whether the dog would be allowed in the house in the first place. He thought until there was only one more dollar left. He looked the smiling barker in the eyes. Chester's face was hot. "Sure you want to spend that last one?" the barker asked. Only then was Chester fully aware that the dog was never coming home with him. And only then did he retract his hand, shove the last dollar in his pocket, walk ashamed to a park bench, and, as any 8-year-old would, cried. "Oh, Chester," his father was sitting next to him, "why couldn't you have just wanted a goldfish?" "I feel sick to my stomach," Chester said, though this quality of sickness wasn't the throw-up kind. "Listen, take your dollar to that man over there." His father pointed to a man beside a giant scale. "He'll try to guess your age or your weight, and if he's wrong, you'll get a prize. You tell him to guess your age." "It's a sure thing, Chester. He'll guess you're 10. You know," he said, "you're like a little old man. You've seen that much." A woman like his mother stepped onto the giant scale. He wanted to ask his father what he meant. What so much had Chester seen? But his father wasn't there anymore. So many things he didn't remember. Like when he was 4 and his father talked to him on the stone bench. Even the next day, when he told his mother, he couldn't remember what his father had said. His mother explained his father was in heaven. Chester didn't know why that mattered. His father was right. The friendly man with the red suspenders guessed Chester was at least 10. The prize was not a giant stuffed dog. "Do you want this plastic wallet?" Chester shook his head. "How about this bag of balloons?" "No." "Squirt gun?" "No." "You've stumped me again, little man." Chester pointed to a string of hot pink beads with a pink high-heeled shoe the size of a small mouse hanging from the bottom. "How about those?" "Mardi Gras beads?" The man raised a triangle eyebrow. Chester nodded, and the man strung them around his neck. "You're a queer one," he said, just as Chester saw David on his sticks, with his pant legs that always looked empty, smiling his big smile. On the drive home, Chester traced the outline of the plastic shoe, running his finger along the curve, from heel to toe, over and over again. He stared out the window at the road ahead, the heat swelling over it in waves. A dark patch, like water, appeared on the pavement. David had told him this was called a mirage. "Mirage," Chester said, pointing out the window. "Mirage," he said when another one appeared. "Mirage," he pointed to a third one. "Mirage."
That was Polly Buckingham, and that story is titled Mirage. Polly says she wrote most of the story in her head on a 3-hour car trip, though she was already familiar with the character of Chester and part of his experience.
This is actually a character that I've been working with for 25 years. And so it was easier for me to work with somebody who I knew well. And the experience of losing $20 trying to win a giant stuffed dog and then having some stranger tell me, oh, you know, go to that guy with the scale, that actually happened to me. So that piece of it was real. And then the rest I just made up around it.
Polly Buckingham is the recipient of a 2014 Washington State Artist Trust Fellowship. Her chapbook, A Year of Silence, won the Jean Leiby Memorial Chapbook Award for Fiction. Our next author is Shan Ray. He grew up in Montana, which means he was very familiar with the stretch of road that takes you through North Idaho and into Spokane.
You know, before it was straight interstate from Montana to here, there were all these two-lane roads basically between stretches of interstate. And you just came across this two-lane bridge and into St. Regis, and there were always fruit sellers on the side, all kinds of stands, and we would always get cherries there.
It's a trip that changes the life of the kid in Shan's story.
Presumably, we had driven 12 hours to see Expo 74. But as we crossed plains and top mountains, my father's face seemed to grow heavy. And on the final span of road near St. Regis, not more than a few hours out from Spokane, it seemed his head was an anvil that rested above his chest. His eyes stared lazily at the road as if to announce a new pattern of sleep. He was a big man, near 6.5 feet tall. His hands held the wheel with a looseness unlike him. "Let's stop here, Dad," I said. "Yes," he said. "Get a bag of cherries for the home stretch." The bag rested on the bench between us, and we each took handfuls into our mouths and spit the pits out the window. The off-white Chevy Impala had cost him $100, and the road could be seen through the floorboards. The wind in the cabin was like something the Spirit of God blew in, set with sunshine and sent from somewhere up in the endless blue. But my father didn't seem to notice. "God is good," I declared loudly, just as I'd seen him do countless times in the box kitchen of our trailer back in Lame Deer. He kept his eyes on the road. These past 3 years, he had become that kind of proclaimer, uttering strange new declarations since he'd found God, words my mind didn't know what to do with. Watching him stand with his arms raised, his hands raking the low ceiling of that slender mobile home, it seemed he'd been turned from something bear-like into something akin to a warrior angel. Face aglow, eyes afire with holy flame, but today something in him was broken. "What is it?" I said. My voice hedged. "Never mind," he said sharply. "Not for young ears." Placing my hands over my ears, I turned my shoulders from him and stared out the window and pouted for a long time. Lolo and the colored Welcome to Idaho sign, 4th of July pass. Trees like more women than I could imagine, staring up at the sky. He set his hand on my shoulder, and I turned to him with my hands still over my ears, my eyes watering. "Hands down," he said. The road fell to a long, slender marsh opening on blue water that expanded suddenly into a vast body flanked by rock and pine. We sped the north side of the lake, and he mentioned the French word for heart and spelled it for me. C-O-E-U-R. It seemed to hurt him to say the letters, and I thought I saw him wince when he pronounced the word whole. Core, he said softly. Like door. He stared at me a moment while he drove, and his face seemed about to break. He looked back at the road. We rose from the water as the highway bent upward and finally plateaued. Your mom is leaving me, he said. She's at Aunt Lori's, I said. Son, your mom asked me to tell you she's with your auntie. She asked me not to hurt your feelings. He touched his right hand to his cheek before placing his hand back on the wheel. She's gone, he said. He cried then, the first I'd ever seen him cry. And I cried, too. High-pitched, the words tripped from my mouth. What do you mean? We're getting a divorce. Why? I asked. She doesn't love me. His left arm was straight now, holding the wheel. With his right forearm, he wiped his eyes. She does, I protested. My voice felt too small to be heard. He gave a weary chuckle and smiled weakly at me before he put both hands on the wheel and looked straight ahead. We rode in silence then until the edge of the city appeared, and we slowed toward the center of town. We followed the cars, and I looked out into each glass and metal encasement where I saw happiness on the faces of men and women, children. He clicked on the radio, and Springsteen rose like a message from a place we never knew. We went down to the river, and into the river we'd dive. Oh, down to the river we did ride. And here, as if held by some miracle, we topped a rise and descended again until the Spokane River lay before us in the distance, silver blue and christened by a flare of gold. Years later, I wondered if it was really Springsteen or just memory crafting something from nothing, something bitter, something true. Look at that, Dad said, and placed his hand on my shoulder again. Will you look at that? Rolling lawns and big tents, all the colors of the rainbow. The river, a gilded frame. A day different than this one, 1974. None of my friend's parents were divorced. Montana lagged 5 years behind Washington, a decade behind California. In the coming years, every one of my friend's parents fractured too, just as my mother and father. My father's chest was like a collapsed cavern that day. When we got out of the car, he took my hand and we walked across the bridge to the U.S. Pavilion. His shoulders were bent inward, his voice so quiet I barely heard him. Let's see what the world has in store, he said.
That was Jan Ray. That story is titled, The Heart is the Door. The divorce rate rose dramatically in the 1970s. In fact, it's been called the divorce boom. Jan says Springsteen's song, The River, did technically come later, but he feels it speaks to the children of those divorces. Jan is the author of the award-winning story collection, American Masculine. Nance Van Winkle has our final story today, and it was inspired by an experience she had back when she was just out of college and working in a hospital.
I worked at, I guess, something that doesn't even exist anymore, a switchboard. And the doctor's lounge was right behind my switchboard. And I remember this doctor coming into the lounge and just sobbing in there, just sobbing.
That doctor, like the one in Nance's story, had to make a tough call about a kid who had been caught out in the snow. Here's Nance.
For the third April morning in a row, Dr. Swift has turned off his pager, put his fingers to his lips, and nodded conspiratorially to Delia, who closes the closet door on him gently. He's perched in her lawn chair in there amid the industrial strength everythings. Cleaners for glass, for chrome, and for the marble hospital foyer, it's her job and hers alone to make shimmer. The doctor's sick, she told the nurse on 2 East, who'd asked if Delia had seen him. Where had she seen him last? As if he were a set of lost car keys. Delia mopped around her. Swish, swish, right up to the tips of those blaringly white shoes. Up on 4 West, Delia told her, and he didn't look good. I think he's sick. This wasn't exactly a lie. In room 213, the Blotto boy's parents waited for the verdict. A leg to go or to stay. After the snowmobile accident, it had taken hours upon hours to reach the boy who'd somehow lost his boot. First the toes had gone, then the foot. Delia imagined the doctor's saws getting bigger. Behind her door, she knew there would be tears for a while as her little transistor radio radiated the war news, death scores, followed by ball scores, then the expo update. From the ruins of old railroad yards and parking lots, the great World's Fair was rising in the still wintry heart of Spokane. The hospital was full of its mishaps. The toppled ladder, a concussion, a broken femur, the nail gun fiasco, nail through a palm, and the wiring job gone awry, a still purpling, still shriveling, electrocuted right arm. From those rooms came languages Delia felt sure could have been hymns from the Stone Age. After the weather forecast, the door would open, the secret door, and the doctor would emerge. Dr. Swift! The paging voice was shrill. The coming weather was sleet, then rain. The door opens. A face peers around it. He nods to Delia, then closes the door. She thinks, we own the dawn hallway. Only steeped inside the closet's ammonia stench may sad resuscitate. In the closet was the necessary alchemical change needed to drive a decision through to its end. She watches the doctor's face to see what he's decided. To save a life, a leg must go. No doubt he'd known that all along, and now to make it happen. Dr. Swift, please dial 2 East. The boy wanted to go to the fair next month, expected to go. Lying there all March and now April, he'd heard the jackhammers rattle the hospital windows. He'd seen the televised footage of the Soviet pavilion with a forest inside it. A big, wide world, the nurses had told him, was coming to our town. And now, stepping into the shadows and out of the doctor's path, Delia tries not to look into those eyes that have the hard black shimmer at the center. Those eyes ablaze with what? Who can say? Ungodly or most holy fire. The sleet rains down. Will a thaw ensue? Will the frost ever quit? Or will the boy's parents step out into it later, after the boy's asleep and the sharpened up saws have done their work and the hallway is pristine again and Delia's door is locked and her yellow rubber gloves snapped off and the mop propped up and the bucket kicked. Kicked hard, little booger.
Nance Van Winkle, reading 1974. Nance is the author of 4 collections of short stories. Her book of poetry, Pacific Walkers, was a finalist for the 2014 Washington State Book Award. Tales from the Fair is produced by Spokane Public Radio. These stories originally appeared in the Spokesman Review and were edited by Carolyn Lamberson. I'm Jessica Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next time with more stories from Jessica Holliday, Samuel Ligon, and Sean Vestal.
There's a pause. And the funny voice says, "But yes, again, sir, why are your bombers flying over our pavilion?"